This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Laura Bridgman was a deaf and blind woman who died in 1889 when Helen Keller was 9 years old. Bridgman had taught the finger alphabet to Keller's teacher, Anne Sullivan, at the Perkins School for the Blind, where Bridgman studied as a child and resided for most of her life. Sullivan later introduced Bridgman to Keller. It was scarlet fever that robbed Bridgman of her sight, hearing, and much of her sense of smell and taste at the age of two. As a child, she became a phenomenon of the Victorian era. Through her, intellectuals of the day explored how people acquire language, moral sensibilities, and the concept of God. Tourists came to see her. Dickens and Darwin wrote about her. My guest Elizabeth Gitter is the author of a new biography of Bridgman called The Imprisoned Guest. Bridgman's early education was supervised by Samuel Howe, who ran the Perkins School. He had been looking for a deaf and blind child to test out some theories of his own about the mind and religion. I asked Gitter what Howe hoped to prove by working with Bridgman.
His hopes, I think, shifted slightly in the course of the first few years that he was teaching her. First, he wanted to show it could be done. And that was a very big deal, to show that the faculty of language was innate, that once you got it going, once you stimulated it, that any child, even one who could not hear or see, could gain language. And that was a very big deal. So that was his first goal. His second goal, which developed and became more intense a little later, was to prove the Calvinists wrong, that humans were not innately imps, fallen, sinful creatures, that they were good, that their moral sense was innate, and that Laura, under the right conditions, would in fact even discover the existence of God without being taught, without dogma, that she would prove the Unitarian point, which he wanted to make. This was a time of religious struggle in Massachusetts between the conservative Congregationalists, what we now call Congregationalists, they called them the Orthodox, and the liberals or the Unitarians. And Howe was a rationalist and a Unitarian liberal, and he wanted to teach the Calvinists a lesson.
Well, let's start with his ability to teach her language. He taught her the finger alphabet, which is, I think, the same alphabet that Helen Keller later
learned. Yeah.
What was his approach to disciplining her and teaching her the finger alphabet?
Well, he developed a very clever, elaborate system for teaching her, which was actually based on the system that had been used with the Wild Boy of Aveyron in France 20 years before. And he pasted labels with raised letters onto common objects like spoon, dish, chair, and taught her to associate the bumps on the letters with the object. And then gradually she began to learn to manipulate the letters. It was a complex process. When she began using the finger alphabet and began to really see that she could converse, then she just took off. And there was no stopping her. She would go all day long demanding, what's this, what's this, what does this mean? Her curiosity was exhausting.
For those of us who've seen The Miracle Worker about Helen Keller and her teacher, we saw her teacher sometimes be very harsh with her in order to discipline her and keep her still and keep her focused on things like learning language. What was Howe's approach to disciplining his student, Laura Bridgman?
Well, I have to add that The Miracle Worker shows a slightly sanitized version, because Anne Sullivan had a ferocious temper and she spanked Helen Keller plenty. But Howe didn't believe in that. He believed in fostering an intense, almost excruciating sense of guilt. And so everything that Laura did kind of got a moral mark. This was good, this was bad. If she did something, and Laura had a temper herself and would become very frustrated and would strike her teachers, bite her teachers, and she would then get the silent treatment. She would be sent into a room by herself and cut off from all conversation. And that for her, as you can imagine, was like being buried alive, terrifying. And so that was his, he did not see it as cruel. He saw it as a gentle and non-punitive way of what he would call awakening her conscience, which he believed was innate and only needed to be awakened.
Well, let's get to Samuel Howe's religious ideas, the principles that he wanted to be able to prove by seeing how his student, the deaf and blind Laura Bridgman, learned about religion. He wanted to prove that people had an innate sense of religion and that they were innately good and they didn't have to be punished and taught with fear about hellfire in order to have some spiritual principles. How did she fare in this area, and what was his approach to conversing with her about religious principles, which are pretty abstract? It's much easier to teach S-P-O-O-N means spoon than it is to communicate what God is.
Well, for a child like Laura, of course, a lot of what she learned was abstract. She learned geography. River was an abstraction. Mountain was an abstraction. Paris was an abstraction. The Romans, I mean, all of the, you know, sort of 80% of what she eventually learned was simply an abstraction to her. But he had not a thoroughly, I would argue, thought out idea about how he was going to go about this, awakening her, what he thought was innate sense of his kind of God. And his real agenda was to teach the Orthodox a lesson. This was a time when there was a struggle over whether there would be religious teaching in the public schools. And he and Horace Mann were fighting fiercely with the Orthodox against the teaching of dogma, religious dogma, in the public schools. So that was really his agenda. But he had a kind of half-baked idea. He would show her the operation of magnets, and that would teach her about invisible forces. He would teach her, he would show her plants growing, and with that somehow this idea would be awakened. He hadn't really thought it out in a very sophisticated way. And it wasn't the God she needed. She was frightened often. The world for a deafblind person can be a very unpredictable place. You're taken here and there. People appear and present themselves to you, and you're not always sure what's going on. And she didn't need this kind of reasonable, distant, beneficent Unitarian God. She wanted a God who would keep her company and who would make her feel comforted, that she would be an intimate God. So eventually she disappointed him bitterly by becoming a Baptist.
That was her parents' religion.
It was her parents' religion, but they hadn't pushed it. They didn't want to alienate Howe. And so they said it was completely up to him. Her religious education was completely up to him. The last thing they wanted was for him to get mad at them and send Laura home, where they would have to deal with her. So they left it to him, but it was something she chose. She was not indoctrinated. She chose it.
So did Howe consider the religious part of his experiment to be a failure?
He considered his whole experiment to be a failure, ultimately. He said that the religious failure was the cause of his general disillusionment with Laura. But really, his disillusionment with her was very complicated. She just didn't turn out to be what he wanted. And maybe no child would have, because she turned into a woman. And it's one thing to have an adorable little girl as your experimental subject. It's another to have a full-grown woman who has demands and can be grouchy and has ideas of her own and is somewhat stubborn and temperamental, and he just couldn't deal with that, although he had loved her as a child.
He had been separated from her for about 16 months after he got married, and when he returned to the Perkins School for the Blind and saw her again, he thought that she had changed. He described her as sometimes looking like a wild young witch or appearing to be going mad. Do you think that she had changed or that he had changed over those 16 months?
I think both had happened. He set off. He married Julia Ward Howe of the Battle Hymn of the Republic fame. She was almost 20 years younger than he. They were the most ill-suited couple you could imagine. They had a horrible marriage, beginning with their honeymoon. And he came back from England not in a good mood. Also, Julia Ward Howe did not care for being around disabled people. They made her uncomfortable. So she was not interested. Laura had lived with Howe before he married, and she, Julia Ward Howe, was not interested in having this arrangement continue. He had also had a baby daughter of his own, so whatever paternal needs he had had that Laura filled were now filled by his own daughter. Meanwhile, Laura at home had had a very difficult time. She was abandoned by this man who had been the center of her life for several years, who had been a father to her, and suddenly he took off. She didn't know where she was going to live when he got back. He left her in the care of two very chilly women, one his sister, who was a most peculiar, reserved, remote person, and a young teacher named Mary Swift Lampson, who was well-meaning but very severe and didn't go in for a lot of play or hugs and cuddles, which Laura liked. So Laura had probably had a difficult time emotionally, and then there was puberty. When he left, she was a child. When he came back, she was adolescent. She was 15, and she had undoubtedly changed physically. She was no longer a cute little girl.
My guest is Elizabeth Gitter, author of The Imprisoned Guest, a biography of Laura Bridgman. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest, Elizabeth Gitter, is the author of a new biography of Laura Bridgman, a deaf and blind woman who learned to read and use the finger alphabet 50 years before Helen Keller. Her first teacher, Samuel Howe, ran the Perkins School for the Blind in Boston, where Bridgman lived most of her life. Well, after Samuel Howe, she had another teacher who was very important in her life. Who was the other teacher?
After Howe was disillusioned with her when he came back from his honeymoon, he turned her over to this extraordinary woman named Sarah White. She devoted herself to Laura. This was Howe's idea. Laura was to be basically in quarantine. She was not to be contaminated by anyone else, and three girls chosen by him from the school could come and visit her at set times, but otherwise she was to be with Sarah White exclusively 24 hours a day and nobody else, and so that her moral character could be shaped to be as refined and virtuous as possible. And Sarah White, for several years, was with her in this unbelievably, suffocatingly intimate way. They were literally joined because Sarah was writing into her hand, to Laura's hand, and back and forth all day long. And everything that Laura did was supervised and monitored by Sarah White. There were no boundaries. So, for example, one day they had quite a blow up because Sarah White instructed Laura to open her mouth so that another blind child could feel Laura's teeth, because the other little girl had a loose tooth, and Sarah White wanted to show her something about teeth. And Laura, who was then a young woman, said, "No, I don't want to open my mouth and have some child stick her finger in, hand in my mouth." And they had a huge fight about it, and Laura was sent into isolation and so on until she submitted. There were just no boundaries. But all in the name of awakening conscience, developing self-control, and so on.
One of the things it seems that Laura Bridgman did learn very thoroughly was guilt and self-recrimination. You describe these episodes of self-punishment. She once, in the closet, hurt herself, and she wrote, "Did you see what I was doing in the closet? My left hand harmed me to blame me for doing wrong, to make me sorry." Talk a little bit about the self-punishment that she inflicted.
Well, she inflicted self-punishment in a couple of ways. One is through what we would now call anorexia. Shortly after Sarah White took over as her teacher in this very intense program of moral education, Laura stopped eating and really was at the point of death. And Howe, who in many ways was a sensible man, not in every way, but in many ways, sort of figured out what was going on, and he instructed Sarah White to back off and let Laura have a little period of relaxation and sea baths and carriage riding. The other way that she seems to have hurt herself, and I'm not quite sure what she meant by my life, but I suppose that she struck herself as a way of expressing her frustration with her own inability to control her outbursts. It's very frustrating being a blind deaf person. You can't express yourself. You can't make yourself understood. You don't know what's going on. And it's not so surprising that this frustration should take the form of kind of violent acting out, especially when you've got a teacher who is telling you, put on your gloves, take off your gloves, put on your galoshes, you're too hot, you're too cold, you know, giving you no space at all.
How old was she when she died, and what were her circumstances at the time?
She died in when she was 59, and she...
This was in 1889?
Mm-hmm. She died at the Perkins School. She had gone back and forth in her later years between her home in Hanover, New Hampshire, and living at the Perkins School. But she spent most of her time living at Perkins, even though it was a school for children. And she had a kind of diminishment at the end of her life, I guess you would say. She didn't have enough stimulation. There weren't enough people. Anne Sullivan was a bright exception, but she didn't have enough people to talk to in her last years. And so she spent a lot of time thinking about religion. And that was her main moral support and emotional support. Howe was basically out of the picture. He died a few years before she did, but he died in 1876. But he had gone on to other things, and she didn't see much of him, although she continued to be very fond of him. The teachers of her early days, the female teachers, were all gone. And so she was rather lonely. It was a sad but not tragic last years that she had.
For many years, people have read Helen Keller's story or even seen the movie about her for inspiration. She's a very inspirational figure. She overcame incredible odds. She was very intelligent. She used language very well. The Laura Bridgman story isn't inspiring in quite the same way. She didn't have as many triumphs. The latter years of her life were kind of sad. She was isolated. Do you think that one reads the Laura Bridgman story for different reasons than one reads the Helen Keller story?
Yes, I think Laura Bridgman's story is inspiring in a different way. She was not a poster child for disability. She was who she was. She was ornery. She was demanding. She complained when she was unhappy. And she was fully a human being. She was not an angel in the way that Helen Keller sort of made herself into with Anne Sullivan's collaboration. She was who she was. And I find that just as inspiring, maybe in some ways more inspiring. It's so liberating. She didn't have to live up to any, even the ideal of the Victorian, you know, suffering angel. She said, no thanks. You know, I want people to talk to. I'm bored. I need more books. My throat hurts. You know, she was, and she was really, really smart. So she was, her story is a story about, I think, a person who, under the most difficult circumstances, formed a complete human, complicated self and held on to it. And I find that inspiring.
Why didn't Laura Bridgman and Helen Keller hit it off?
Well, by the time that Helen Keller was just a little girl and Laura was frail, older woman. And Laura, at the end of her life, became more and more fastidious. She couldn't stand the idea of rambunctious children and dirty hands and disorder. And Helen Keller was a very ebullient, affectionate, bouncy little girl. So she came bouncing in to meet Laura Bridgman, who had made a doll for her. Laura sent the doll down, made the doll's clothes, and the doll was sent down to Alabama. Ann Sullivan brought it with her. So Helen Keller was very eager to meet the doll's dressmaker when she got to Perkins School, and walked in, and Laura was sort of horrified by this rambunctious child and said, don't touch this, you'll get it dirty, and don't touch that, you'll get it dirty. And then at the end of their not very happy interview, Helen threw her arms around Laura's neck, Helen Keller was a big hugger and kisser in those days, and stepped all over Laura's feet, and Laura was not very happy about it. So they were very different personalities.
Well, Elizabeth Gitter, I want to thank you for talking with us.
Well, thank you.
Elizabeth Gitter is the author of The Imprisoned Guest. She's a professor of English at the City University of New York's John Jay College. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.